The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
David and Alan and I decided to use a koan for the central focus of this sesshin that's probably familiar to many of you. You may have heard it before in sesshin or in a koan cafe or koan salon, or maybe you've even worked on it in your koan practice. So as with everything we encounter, we want to be curious, let ourselves hear these words as if we were hearing them for the very first time. I'll read the koan and then comment on it. It's case 89 from the Blue Cliff Record. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion expect to do with so many hands and eyes?" Dao Wu said, "It's like a person in the middle of the night whose hand reaches out for the pillow." Yunyan said, "Ah, I understand." Dao Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yunyan said, "Everywhere on the body is hands and eyes." Dao Wu said, "You've said quite a bit, but you've only said 8/10. Yunyan said, "Elder brother, how do you understand it?" And Dao Wu said, "All over the body is hands and eyes." So these two characters who are having an exchange in this well-known koan were both fellow students of the same teacher. Yunyan and Dao Wu studied together under Yao Shan. They lived in the 8th and 9th century. Yunyan was a little bit younger than Dao Wu, but they were both great teachers in their own right. And in fact, Yunyan, the younger of the two, had as one of his students the famous Dong Shan, who is quite important in our Soto lineage as being one of the main teachers in the Cao Dong school, Dong Shan. So these two are often the subjects of koans in our koan collection and in other stories about them. Often one of them will take the role of the one who corrects the first one. And in this case, Dao Wu is the, you might say, the elder teacher. He actually was literally elder in years. But yeah, Yunyan is not less than Dao Wu in this story. And what we have to do whenever we hear koans is immerse ourselves in the experience of the people who are in dialogue with each other, taking one side and taking the other. One of the reasons that we wanted to use this koan is because it's about the Bodhisattva of compassion, a figure in the history of Zen and Buddhism who is so important as the embodiment of compassion. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, who begins the Heart Sutra, was the Sanskrit name for this figure, a bodhisattva, a wisdom being who could receive the suffering of the world as his, in this case, own experience. And later, when this figure, Avalokiteshvara, made the journey in mythology and in culture to China and then Japan, in China, he underwent a transformation to a female figure, Guan Yin, which also means the one who perceives the sounds of the world, the sounds of suffering. And starting in India, there was a mythology around this bodhisattva character, a wisdom being, not necessarily a human being, but a part of the humanity of every person who studies the Great Way. We have bodhisattvas that represent all kinds of positive impulses in our hearts and minds and bodies. Guan Yin, representing compassion, Manjushri, wisdom, and there are many others. So Guan Yin became a woman in China and went to Japan as another idea, and we call her in Japan Kanzeon or Kanon. So whatever the name, the meaning is the one who receives, the receiver, the one who can feel, can experience the suffering of the world, and through that receiving alone, transmutes, we might say, the suffering into compassion. We've been talking a lot about compassion recently at our temple practices, a lot of talks about the world situation and how to meet this great suffering. I didn't look it up this morning, but in at least one of my talks recently, I referred to a website that catalogs how many armed conflicts are happening in the world at any time. And the last time I looked, it was 110. I asked a friend of mine who works for the State Department what his opinion was, how many armed conflicts, and he said, I'm gonna guess 45. And he was quite surprised at that number of 110. One of the things that happens in this story between these two dear friends, these two Dharma brothers, is that one of them, Dao Wu, says to the other, Yun Yan, you understand what's happening in this koan, but you're only getting 8/10 of it, which is an important point when you're studying this koan formally as part of the koan curriculum. What does it mean to only understand 8/10? And I think of this in relationship to those 110 armed conflicts in the world. Right now, if we turn ourselves into the bodhisattva of compassion and receive the suffering of the world, to know that in 110 separate places on the globe, people are killing each other, using all the weapons that human beings with our immense creativity have come up with. Knives and guns and bombs, sometimes our own hands. There's suffering happening everywhere. Not right here, maybe, although it could be that maybe you're suffering personally. And if you are, Guan Yin is also aware, this mythical figure, this wonderful compassion-oriented being that's part of all of us. We're not just violent beings, we're also compassionate beings. It's important to know this, that allowing ourselves to open up, as Robert Aitken says in his lovely piece about the bodhisattva of compassion, Kanzeon, that our job is to open up to this, just like Guan Yin, just like Kanon. And when that happens, when we truly wake up, open up to a kind of reality of the world, it's impossible for us to know all the details of it. Some of us protect our hearts by gathering lots and lots of information. We're on social media and we watch television, listen to the radio, read newspapers. We want to gather as many facts as possible about what's going on. But our focus, it can't be as broad as Guanyin's focus, which in the mythology that came to us from India to China, depicted Guanyin as having thousands of arms and thousands of eyes, or sometimes thousands of ears, aware of every little moment of suffering happening at any given time. When the teachers were talking about this subject yesterday in our meeting that we had to prepare for this sesshin, and then again when we met with Michael to talk about the answer to the question that we had posed yesterday about what brings you here in the middle of a world on fire. Alan reminded us of the story of the Buddha. When he was a bodhisattva, many previous lives of the Buddha, according to the mythology, where he was various animals and then human beings too, always devoting himself as a bodhisattva, this great vow to never rest as long as human beings, all beings, are suffering, which means really, I think, to never rest. And he reminded us of the beautiful story, which you may have heard me tell before or others, about the Buddha when he was a little bodhisattva in the shape of a small bird. And he was flying over a raging forest fire. And seeing it, he knew that he had to give his utmost to put that fire out. And so this little tiny bird kept flying back and forth, sucking up water from a nearby lake and emptying it out on the fire, a little tiny beak with water in it. Not so effective, we might think. And the first time I ever heard that story, it made me very sad. Sad because the little bird became exhausted from his efforts and he fell to the earth and died and was consumed by the fire. Not a very cheerful story, not a very optimistic story, we have to say. But then later I found out that there's a part two to the story, that all the gods in the heavens, in the heavenly realm, in Tushita heaven, were watching the bird go back and forth and back and forth. They weren't intervening, they weren't putting the fire out, but they observed the little bird going back and forth and back and forth and finally falling to the earth and being consumed by the flames. And it broke their hearts and they started weeping, crying, tears falling from the heavens and putting out the great fire. One of the teachings of our way is that everything that we do matters, but we can't always know the outcome of what we do. The important thing is to not close down from suffering. It's to not turn away, but also to not overwhelm ourselves, perhaps. Not all of us can be bodhisattvas like the little bird. Although some people have done that, and some people are doing that right now in many places on the globe, throwing themselves into the fight for justice, throwing themselves into wars and any work that they can do to help heal the world, even if it seems impossible. In our own way, every single one of us is doing this, Sometimes we summon up the great courage to turn towards the suffering, and sometimes it overwhelms us, and short of falling into the flames and burning up ourselves, we retreat. We give ourselves a little break. We protect ourselves, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's also an act of great compassion. When we do that, it means that we have the capacity to return and face the suffering again. We have more time to do whatever it is that we, as the unique individuals we are capable of. Every one of us listening to this talk right now is capable of something different. Although we're all humans with the same kinds of skin bags and organs and interior and exterior and thoughts and emotions and sensations, we're also quite unique in the way that karma has, through its infinite numbers of causes and conditions, led us to this moment in our lives, this moment that is listening to a talk about a mythical person who may or may not exist, but exists on some level in our own hearts. When this ideal of the Bodhisattva was coming up in India and later spread to China and flowered in the Mahayana traditions in Tibet and China and Japan and Korea and Vietnam, this great vehicle, this great ship of compassion that carries us all. Some of the depictions, as I said, of Guan Yin had her with thousands of arms, eyes, and hands. There's a lovely little quote in a new translation of the Blue Cliff Record where this koan comes from. This translator, Matthew Juksan Sullivan, translates the title as "The Garden of Flowers and Weeds." A lovely name for the Blue Cliff Record. Flowers grow, weeds grow, flowers fall, weeds fall. We are constantly dividing ourselves between likes and dislikes, weeds and flowers, between right and wrong and good and bad. But the work in Zen is to see through those divisions, because if we don't, then we live divided lives. And so this healing force that heals the divisions in our hearts also begins to perhaps heal the divisions in the world. And the very first Mahayana sutra that was written in India portrays Kanzeyan as a miracle worker. Impossible work taken on by this figure, which is what we all have to do on some level in, as I said, our unique way. So here's a quote from that little sutra that I found really beautiful and inspiring. It's from a sutra that was written in the 4th century called the Baskets Display Sutra. And it goes like this. Avalokiteshvara, lover of lotuses, giver of the supreme boon, who brings relief, who has 100,000 arms, who has 100,000 times 10 million eyes, who has 11 heads, who completely frees all beings, who brings relief to turtles, crocodiles, and fish, who creates the greatest mass of wisdom, who brings joy, who is a splendor of jewels, and who has hundreds of thousands of samadhis as numerous as atoms. This pointing to the vast capabilities, the vast capacities of this bodhisattva, and really of all of us, the healing that comes from opening as much as possible. later became a kind of a cult practice in China, especially around the time that the two characters, the two teachers in our story, were living. And there was a reaction to this kind of magical thinking that if you reached out to Kanon, to Guanyin, to Avalokiteshvara with great sincerity and chanted the sutra that was a condensed version, the 10-line Kanzeon Sutra that we chanted earlier this morning. If you do it hundreds and thousands of times, you'll have good fortune. And there was a story about somebody who chanted it and was saved from execution. So this took wing, you might say. Lots of people thought this was a good thing to do. But then there were some other people who thought it was a little bit off base to supplicate yourself to a supernatural being. That wasn't what Zen is all about. And Dao Wu was one of those teachers. And so when Dao Wu answers his friend's question, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion do with all those hands and eyes? A question coming from this mythological depiction. He uses a very ordinary metaphor. It's like someone in the middle of the night reaching out to adjust their pillow while they sleep. A lot of us know this feeling. Sometimes some of the commentators on this koan talk about waking up and adjusting the pillow. But I know, even when I don't wake up, I sometimes find that when I wake up in the morning, my pillow's in a different position than it was before. And I like that idea about what Dao Wu is saying here. If we completely devote ourselves to being open, then something happens where we don't have to think about being compassionate. We don't have to think about being bodhisattvas. We naturally turn into bodhisattvas. All of us unique bodhisattvas, bringing whatever qualities that we have cultivated out into the world and to ourselves. Robert Aitken says, the profound act of opening myself is what it takes to begin to turn our own distress, our own sorrows, our own confusion, our own lack of understanding, our own incapacity to ever know 100% of anything. Even though it might be comforting, understanding what exactly is happening in those 110 locations, understanding all of the causes and conditions that led people to be fighting and killing each other all over the globe, it might be a little bit helpful, but ultimately it's unknowable. We can't go back and find the original source of all this distress unless we open ourselves and see that the original source might simply be the way we divide the world in our own hearts. I know I do this all the time. I divide myself to myself. I can be very mean to me. I can also be very kind to me. In that little division in my own heart, could this be the source of everything that human beings do to keep that sense of division alive and to take it to its ultimate outcome, which is complete destruction? That could happen. The little bird can only fit enough water in his beak for just a little bit of saving. We can't do it all. We can't do the 100%. I think 8/10 is quite a big percentage. Could 8/10 be enough? Could 1/10 be enough? Could one beakful of water be enough? And in Zen practice, we say, yes, yes, yes. The littlest, tiniest moment of turning towards with an open heart is everything. Yunyan asked Dawu, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion expect to do with so many hands and eyes? Dawu said, it's like a person in the middle of the night whose hand reaches out for the pillow. Yunyan said, ah, I understand. Dawu said, how do you understand it? Yunyan said, everywhere on the body is hands and eyes. Dawu said, you've said quite a bit, but you've only said 8/10. Yunyan said, elder brother, how do you understand it? Dawu said, all over the body are hands and eyes. Thank you. Please make yourselves comfortable. We'll have our Dharma dialogue. And please raise your Zoom hand if you want to ask a question, make a comment, anything that's coming up for you. Yes, Barry.
That was an astonishing talk in terms of its complexity. I'm just blown away by it. In terms of this whole notion of turning towards, I met with a Hopi man once to talk to him about his father, who was a major advocate for Hopi rights, and not having huge corporations exploit their resources, but rather have the Hopi be in charge of their own resources. And he even met with the United Nations on several occasions advocating. How successful was he? Well, sometimes a bit. And towards the end of our conversation, I said, so how do you sum up your father's impact? And he said, he did what he could. And I love that phrase. It stays with me. He did what he could. And I agree with you, 8/10. If I could get to 8/10, I'd be delirious.
Yeah. How does it manifest in your life, Barry? Not as a just as a memory of that wonderful conversation, but that little pithy saying, how is it for you? What comes up?
The way it manifests is I don't feel that I can turn towards the Middle East and have any impact. To me, it's too distant and too massive. I help people with trauma. I turn towards that. I sit with misery. I do what I can for them. And I don't aspire for international impact.
Yeah, I think that not aspiring is really lovely. I think it's pretty straightforward, right? But the impact you can have right where you are is so important. Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Barry. Paul.
Thank you, Melissa, for the talk. This little bird is very much as far as with me. And I mean, there's what's coming up for me is that I, at one level, this little bird had no choice. I mean, that's what this bird needed to do. In this case, yes, become this past life of the Buddha. And I see this little creep in my mind that says, I should be the little bird. And I think about it because so I have a bird feeder, and I just put bird food out there. And there's never just one little bird. There's always a lot of little birds there. And so these little birds that did not, you know, go back and forth with the water, that that was no less of an act. That was not somehow the wrong act to take. That at least for me, I'm not going to Ukraine. I'm not going to Israel or Gaza, and I am doing everything that I can for peace. And it's one of those little birds that acted completely in another way.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. We are all little birds. I was really caught by what Barry said about mm-hmm. not aspiring to global impact. But I think we should aspire to universal impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in this very intimate way. So much of this suffering, so much of our suffering as human beings is about this separation, this delusion of separation and this comparison. I'm not like that. I am like this. I'm this kind of little bird. all of that. And in some ways, I think we're encouraged in this koan and in our practice to go beyond whatever notion we have of compassion, right? Whatever we think it is, it is much more than that. Hands and eyes all over the body, every action is kanzeon. And somehow this has to do with receiving, with opening mm-hmm. ourselves. Some great mystery here.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to add to that, to really value all those other little birds is very much like what we're all talking about, right? Because I keep going, my State Department friend, I mean, he's really retired. He has just a little tiny job in the State Department now. He's mostly a university professor, but he just went to Ukraine for 2 weeks and he had a great time because he didn't try to stop the conflict, but he connected to all these people in all these various places as human beings. He teaches a course for Ukrainians on world history or something like that. Anyway, that's a long story. But we have another friend who's in Gaza right now, organizing food for everyone, on both sides of the conflict, because there's so much going on where people aren't getting essential care and food. So, those are those birds, right? And we're the other birds. And it's important to remember what David's pointing to. I just want to underline it, this universality of experience. We are all connected. There's no way to say that we are not connected is just contributing to division. So thank you. Yeah, and also, it's easy for David and me to answer these questions, but Alan, if you ever want to pipe up, just unmute yourself and speak. You're part of this too, but I can't even see you on my screen. Bob.
Thanks for that talk, Melissa. It was excellent. What came up for me, the pillow thing, I don't purport to understand the pillow aspect of this koan, but it did bring up When I was a young man, I worked for the UN, and I was a political advocate for refugees from Indochina. And being young and idealistic, I thought I could solve the whole problem. And it caused me a lot of pain because it's just the problem was so enormous. And I finally met Sister Elaine, and I started sitting with Sister Elaine, and I got to a point where I could say, I can't solve the problem, but I can help this family sitting in front of me. And that made the job much more tolerable. And years later, I came back to the States, and I ran a group home for abused kids. And once again, I thought, I've got to solve this problem. And, you know, I'm going to get a degree in public policy, and we're going to solve this problem once and for all. And it's just idealism. I don't have the power to solve the problem. But I could help the kids that were there. And so that story just brought up a lot of that for me.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, and this just doing what we can do, you know, do what you can do, as Barry's friend said, and in some way it's never enough, right? And our hearts break when we meet suffering because we cannot stop it. But somehow in the middle of it all, we are called upon as Zen practitioners to do something. Of course, we're called upon to do nothing, but do something, talk to the person in front of you, meet what is here, and then in each action, everything is complete. We act in alignment with our bodhisattva vow. This vow, the vow is not to fix the world, but to be present, to be present in this world. And as Melissa alluded to, some possibility of transformation or something happening that is beyond rational, beyond what we think, but to takes great courage and great heart to do this.
Just kind of adding to that, if I may, I'm thinking of all these comments are weaving together for me, including David's just now, and I'm thinking of Paul's birds. And how, you know, what birds naturally do is they sing. And I was imagining the birds that weren't flying into the fire singing, and wondering how much good has been done in the world because someone heard a bird singing at a certain moment and it touched their heart, you know. And so what do we do that comes from our natures that is like singing? And it's got, you know, Bob just gave us an example. You know, we reach out to the children we're taking care of. Barry gave an example, you know, in our, if we're healers, we heal. And so, and this, these are examples of what David was saying, that we just live our lives with an open heart and keep hearing the cries of the world and not try to fix it, but keep singing through it, singing in that way that might change much more than we ever imagined.
Yeah, beautiful. Lovely. Thank you. Thank you. Anne.
Yeah, I keep being almost horrified at the difference in me between a knowing of something abstractly and a knowing it physically. And the abstractly, although it's been all my life, I'm 77, I've lived with TVs and computers and all my life, but I can dismiss it fairly quickly. I'm initially horrified and then I go, but a physical knowing where I've known the place or I've been there, or even a certain kind of tree in Colorado that's dying from drought causes me more pain than reading about people in Gaza. And it's feels very human. It feels like impossible to get around, that if I've had a physical connection, I believe it in a way that I never believe things I just hear about. So it means I can only do things locally, because the other flits away too easily and is forgotten, or it just goes behind the bush.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying, Anne. And Zen practice is so focused on the physical, right? We sit upright and unmoving as best we can. We feel the breath in our body. We experience things intimately. We talk about the intimacy of encountering everything. And a lot of people I've been talking to who are in such distress about many of these things that are going on in the world, there's a way of filling up on abstraction. And you're pointing to being more intimate with what's right here, right? And the abstraction just builds on itself and creates, you know, the internet is a is just bad medicine for the little brains we have. We can't retain all that abstract information, but one encounter with something that stays with us, and of course then we can respond. Yeah, thank you. Jenny.
When you were talking, I was just having this vision of like what I can expect from here on out is my capabilities dropping away. And I was having this vision of like, nobody's going to tell me and everybody's just going to back away and the world's going to recede. And then it occurred to me that the way I have that fear is because that's what I do. I back away when people get difficult. And so that's what I'm going to expect of everyone to do when I get difficult. And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, when I think these moments when we see the future that we imagine is some kind of projection of ourselves, and that there's possibility to change our future, which of course is only ever here, but change the future in practicing. And we, in some ways, we can't practice until we realize that practice is necessary. I think all of us are here because something in our life has taught us, or we have seen how again and again we forget, or again and again we get lost, or again and again we turn away. And the wonderful, wonderful part of Zen, and I think Melissa referred to this, is that even for a moment coming back in the middle of a long sitting with mind gone somewhere else for a cigarette break out the back door, one moment of coming back is the fulfillment of our bodhisattva vows. And we don't have to string moments together to pile them up to get enough to make sure, just in the moment, the possibility of saving poor old Jenny, who's such a troublemaker. We can save her right now in this moment.
I was thinking, Jenny, of when my father was losing his faculties and becoming weaker, and his great bodhisattva activity became to allow us to help him. Never done much before. Mm-hmm. And I grew closer to my siblings than I'd ever been as we became a team helping him. And just that openness to being helped was an amazing activity that he did. And I think he knew what he was doing. So we don't know, you know, we may not need as many faculties as we think. We're a lot of good in the world.
Highly overrated, these faculties.
There's some new research on the healing power of forgetting. Trying to keep everything in our minds, trying to get to the 100% is not so healthy for us. And just there's this kind of presence. When you're in the presence of a bodhisattva, like you were with your father, you become a bodhisattva. It's contagious, just like violence is contagious. Compassion is also contagious. Thank you. Jeannie.
It struck me as people were talking that a big part of the suffering I've been seeing this month is people feeling powerless, people here, my friends, me, feeling powerless and not being able to do anything, because what our goal is to stop the violence in Israel or Gaza or Ukraine. And, you know, and then we do violence to ourselves by judging, actually, you know, as Alan said about his father, or you know, a lot of us have been saying, you know, it's maybe singing or letting someone take care of you is your bodhisattva activity, right? Is that that is the healing of the world if we're really connected. So it did something to heal me, you know, when I stop myself from acting because it's not enough. It's not affecting those folks in Gaza who are getting decimated. And then I don't do the positive thing that I could do right here, then that's adding to the violence. So thank you, all of you, for what you're saying.
I really love what you're saying, Jeannie, because to keep all of this stuff from the media in our heads and that leading to the feeling of helplessness, it is thoroughly exhausting, right? And then, as you say, we do have power to meet the moment where we are, but if we're exhausted by paying attention to the powerlessness, it's a spiral, right? It's a spiral that just leads to death and destruction. So this is where we want to value our wonderful hearts that suffer with the information we're getting, but also see clearly into the nature of what we're actually experiencing and what's happening all over. And it's all over the world. That's the thing that just, when I saw the list of conflicts, some of the countries, I didn't even know the names of those countries. But people are doing terrible things to each other right there. What can I do? And instead of going and trying to investigate each country, I sat with the nature of being human and this tendency to divide. And it's been quite powerful for me. I think you're pointing to something similar. Yeah, thank you. Pierce.
You're muted, Pierce.
I have always felt quite bewildered by this reading by Robert Aiken. And indeed, I think I'm bewildered by compassion. What is it? Where does it come from? How do you cultivate it? And I think actually that he gives a little bit of a clue at the end when he says that it comes from opening oneself up, which I take to mean our practice of meeting what is arising rather than turning away. And also, Melissa, I think you gave me a clue there when you said it's contagious, just like anger, because I can see very clearly the way anger is spreading from what happened on October 7th, even in this country. And so that is a way of understanding it. And also, you know, I find the koan somewhat bewildering also, especially this, what I think of as this Indian image of the thousand hands and eyes. But I think there's a little clue in the pillow, you know, reaching for the pillow. That's something I know about. My pillows are always slipping out from under my head, and I need to have a neck support, which I have put into the pillowcase. So I know all about that. So sitting with that, the intimacy of that, the kind of just the kind of mundane closeness of it is a little bit of a clue for me. Thank you.
Beautiful. And I think too, you know, this the little controversy in the 8th and 9th century about appealing to Kanon and Dao Wu using this lovely imagery of something that we all know, moving the pillow in the middle of the night. It shifts the whole conversation to I don't even have to do anything. That doing comes naturally out of being, and there's a way forward. It's not necessarily, I mean, it is hopeless, let's face it. And there are these little gleams of light in the darkness always. And the darker it is, I think the brighter those little gleams are. And we don't think in the middle of the night, I am going to adjust the pillow. And I think that's the clue there for you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Susan, last one.
I guess this is probably sort of a take on what everybody's been saying, but I found myself so far in this sesshin, just totally engaged and immersed in the image of Kanzeon, Kan Wan Yin. I have her sitting right on my little altar right beside me. And so the koan, and that I particularly was engaged with the thousands and thousands, innumerable eyes and points of contact in the body, in her body, in the body of everything. I forgot where I was going with that. That no matter what we're doing, we often don't know what effect we're having on someone. And it's happened, you know, some people, you know, it's happened to me being on the other side where somebody's just saying, you know, some story, and something that they say is like, that's exactly what I needed to hear right this instant. And they may never know that. And I might know it and not know it until, you know, years later, I say, oh, you know what, some that stranger on that bus made all the difference in my life. And so the, for me, that pillow image, it happens so unconsciously. The little adjustments, that one hand or one point of contact can make, that is hugely compassionate in our own or perhaps somebody else's teensy weensy little life. And yet it happens, and it can be big for somebody. And I'm being totally inarticulate on this, but that's I'm just so engaged with that, the thousands, the big, all made up of tiny little things that matter.
Right. Well, and I think you're pointing, Susan, to a kind of way of life that is not instrumental. Well, let me do this so that will happen, but a kind of life of generosity and trusting. Mm-hmm. I loved Alan's image of singing our mm-hmm. song, and I think we're all singing our song. And just before you, as Pierce was talking, I was just delighting in his confusion. Pierce has such an engaged way of presenting confusion as an interesting place. It's like I try to avoid it at all costs.
Right.
Pierce is like, well, this is how it is. And then there's this little thing here and there. And that, so the song we sing, we can never know it from the outside. Mm-hmm. Right? You, Susan, being Susan, it's not like you wake up in the morning and say, well, I better try to be Susan today. Right? It's and that is more than enough, that all of us touch and are touched in that way, middle of the night, reaching for the pillow, already accomplished. Yeah.
I just love what you said too, Susan. I can't remember exactly what it was, something like all the tiny little things that matter, you know, and this is, I keep thinking about one of my favorite poems by Wendell Berry, The Law That Marries All Things. And it's a wonderful poem for many reasons, but the law can be also a reference to the Dharma, mm-hmm. you know, it's the way things are. Mm-hmm. And just like Alan was saying about the singing, he says at one point in this fairly long poem, you must enter singing into it. Mm-hmm. It's the great chorus of parts. Mm-hmm. And that's just what I heard you saying. And then he says, the only outlawry is in division. Mm-hmm. And then right at the end of the poem, he says, meet me, the red bird sings. Mm-hmm. Here, mm-hmm. here, here, here. That's the end of the poem. I just always, you know, he sets up a little argument about this, and then that's it. Right here, the intimacy of that tree that Anne was talking about. The not knowing that something that you may have said was retained by somebody forever in their hearts and just directed their lives. You know, the indigenous man that spoke to Barry, he might have just tossed that off, but it, now we have it. Mm-hmm. So everything we do has a, it's part of the great chorus of parts that Barry's talking. That's what I'm hearing, and you were very clear to me. Other people too. So, yeah, thank you all for a wonderful Dharma dialogue, and we're going to go back to sitting. Is that right? The people who are running the session will take us to the next step.